forth, he filed for a scheduled route into the Aleutian Islands. That service was begun on a temporary certificate in 1948, and the initial schedule at that time called for a three-day trip, weather permitting, twice a week, from Anchorage to Attu Island, which incidentally is in the Eastern Hemisphere. The first day's schedule called for stops at King Salmon Naknek, Port Hyden, Cold Bay, Dutch Harbor, Umnak, and hopefully remain overnight at Adak, which is 1,241 miles from here. The second day consisted of flying from Adak to Shemya to Attu, which around the Aleutians is 1,676 miles, and then back through Shemya to Adak the second night with a reversed itinerary coming back into Anchorage on the third night. Reeve, as with all of the other airlines that were certificated in the early 50s, was federally subsidized. The Civil Aeronautics Board had determined that it was essential that the air transportation system in Alaska be developed in a formal and logical manner. And, of course, the federal government was obligated to provide the revenues necessary to assure this type of good transportation system. There just wasn't enough business to pay all of the bills for what the customers wanted. At this point in time, in 1950, we were now incorporated and had changed the name from Reeve Airways to Reeve Aleutian Airways. We operated three DC-3s. We also had a Lockheed 10 Electra. And Ray, I think that we sold ours for the same reason that you did. Somebody else needed them more than we did for a better price. Through the 1950s, we went through a transitional period. There were very few airports in the Aleutians other than the military facilities. Naturally, the World War II military bases in the Aleutians had been built where the civilian communities weren't. We got a Grumman Goose amphibian to provide service to several of the cannery communities, and eventually acquired a Sikorsky S-43, which was a 21-passenger amphibian. And we operated those aircraft until about 1958, when airports had finally been built at enough of the communities that we could go all wheels. The DC-3, of course, was the mainstay of our fleet until we acquired our first DC-4 in 1958. All of a sudden, we had the ability to get to Shemya and Attu in one day. We had four engine safety as compared to two engine safety. However, as I recall, the DC-4 was basically a tri-motor airplane. There was always one feathered, but not necessarily as many as with Connie. The DC-4s were replaced in the early 1960s by DC-6s, and finally in 1968, 10 years behind Northern Consolidated and Wien Air Alaska, Reeve Airways became a turbine airline also with our first Lockheed Electra, which incidentally was acquired from Air New Zealand. Getting from 1968 to 1979, 1980, as far as Bob Reeve's operation and Revolution Airways is concerned, we have gone from about a 12 or 13 airplane piston engine fleet to now five turboprops, three Electras and two Japanese YS-11s. The general who will be speaking tomorrow, of course, directed the bombing operations against Dutch Harbor in the Aleutians. We took our first YS-11 on a demonstration flight into Dutch Harbor in the fall of 1972. The flight crew was a Japanese flight crew. And after finding Dutch Harbor behind the cliff through the fog and saying, ah, so full fraps, he landed. And one of the first things he said is, the Japanese returned to Dutch Harbor, finally, in 1972. Ted, how are we doing for time? The movie is about 30 minutes. Okay, and at the end of the movie, if there is time or whatever the schedule permits, I've glossed over an awful lot of items. If any of you have any specific questions in your mind or anything that you would like to ask, we can probably field a few different stories from there. Okay? Gather up the rest of the participants or whatever. For those of you who don't know about them, there are a couple of books that relate to the old bush pilots. There is one about Bob Reeve. This is not an advertisement, it's just a statement. The title of the book about Bob Reeve is Glacier Pilot. The author is Beth Day, and it is available here in town. In addition to being a story about Bob Reeve, it mentions anecdotes and stories about many of the other old bush pilots in Alaska. The second good reference book about flying in Alaska is a series of written portraits of bush pilots called The Flying North. The author there was Jean Potter, and she did this during World War II. So for any of you that are interested in further reading, here are a couple of good ones.
There's another book entitled What? No Landing Field by Bob Ellis. This is an advertisement, and somewhere in town there are 250 copies of these books, some of which are to be made available at the book cache. One of my relatives, Terry Ellis, is doing my work for me, and I don't know whether the books have arrived at the cache yet or what the situation is, but I did want you to know that you have something else to look forward to.
I'd like to ask the people that are here if they would do me a favor. It's something that I neglected to do. A number of people have brought it up, and I think it's an excellent idea. If you would please sign this tablet, because we'd like to have a record of the people that have attended this event. We'll just kind of pass it around informally, or if you don't get a chance to sign it, it'll be out on that front desk there. Also, I want to make an announcement about the banquet. If you want to attend the banquet, it's $25 per plate, the proverbial crab leg and salmon dinner. And we're going to be showing a lot of old movies that are from people's private collections. And we're going to have more people speaking that didn't get a chance to speak or that had more to say. It's going to be more informal. There's not going to be any time restrictions. So check with Ingrid Peterson out there at the front desk, and she'll sell you a little ticket. It starts at 5 in the afternoon, cocktail hour. We're going to try to get underway fairly early, around 6:30 at the latest, so we can get the eating out of the way so we can get into the... We'll go ahead and present this film now. I'm real eager to see it. I've never seen it myself, so I hope you all enjoy it. I'd like to come up and speak for a minute or two as to some circumstances surrounding the making of this film.
There was one interesting thing that happened while we were making this film. We went to Dutch Harbor. Unfortunately, it was not in this footage. Bob Reeve said that we'd had enough footage on this. And we went to the Greek Orthodox Church there and had the priest get on to all of his vestments. We took a bunch of pictures and so forth. And he was very cooperative. So we said, well, what can we do to thank you for getting into all your robes and letting us take the pictures inside the church and of the church and so forth? He said, well, this church is very badly in need of a paint job. And if you can do anything about that, why, we'd appreciate it very much. So I said, I'm sure that we'd do something. So when he got back to Anchorage, I went to the Lions Club and showed him some photographs of the church down there, which probably hadn't had any paint in 50 or 4 years. So the Lions Club gave me, I was a member of the Lions Club, gave me $200. Then I went over to Sears and Roebuck, got a hold of the manager, and said, look, I think probably we could do a pretty good job if you will give us the paint for free or for wholesale. So he said, well, chop it right in half. So he gave us a lot of white enamel paint for the outside of the church or whatever kind of paint they used. And then we went over to Bob Reeve and said, Bob, I'm sure that the priest down there would appreciate if you'd haul this paint down there for free. And he said, well, he's a pretty good friend of mine, so we'll carry it down. So then it painted the outside of the church down there. We got enough paint to paint the whole outside of the church. And I got the most wonderful letter from that priest, and I keep this, and I've got it framed. And it says, Dear Herb Hilcher, we are so much indebted to you for the paint for our church that our congregation prays for your soul every Friday and Saturday night. So I've only got the other 5 days to find out who will do it, and I got it made.
Thank you. We're going to have to move right along here. We have another Alaskan aviation great in our midst. And I won't go into too much detail on this guy's life because apparently he's very well known here. A lot of people have been very happy to see him make it up here. And from what I hear, he travels back and forth to Alaska quite frequently. Mr. Frank Barr.
When he said great, I didn't know whether he was referring to my size, my girth, or what. Now, when he told me that he'd like to have me give a talk, I didn't know what to talk about. At first, I thought, well, it would be well, perhaps, if I'd give a sort of a thumbnail sketch of some of the old flyers. But I talked to some of them, and they knew that I was raised in a very straight-laced family and had a great reputation for veracity, truth, and whatnot, and they wouldn't have it. They didn't want me to tell about them. In fact, they became so threatening that I was intimidated and I had to change my mind. So I believe now that I will just ramble on and tell a few things about some of the old airplanes instead. It's easy for me to ramble on. Most old people do. The Hamilton airplane was mentioned here. Now, I had a Hamilton. It had the wrinkled skin like the Ford Trimotor. It was a smaller plane, single engine. Ween had one, but his had a much more modern engine. It had a 450 Wasp in it. I had a 400 horsepower Model A which none of you have never ever seen, I'm sure. It was a good airplane. I traded my Pilgrim to Jack Peck for it, and a Curtiss Thrush, and a truckload of spare engines and airplane parts. I flew it up from Bethel, and I had occasion to land it flat. I wasn't very familiar with it. And I began to run out of field, and I ground looped it at the end. And I found out that was the greatest ground looping airplane, because it had a very wide tread, and the shock struts run straight up to the spars and air wheels, and you could swing that right around, and the wings wouldn't even tip. It was a very comforting airplane to fly in some ways. The cockpit had no lining of any type in it, and it was metal, and it was a bit noisy in there, something like being inside of a snare drum when somebody was playing on it. But it didn't make any difference to me. I didn't know in those days that an airplane was supposed to be comfortable. This engine now, this Model A Wasp, was 400 horsepower. That was before they put any enclosures around the push rods. All these push rods were dancing up and down outside. There was no covers over, no rocker box proper for the rockers. They were out in the open working. It was nice to sit there and watch them all working, as long as they worked, you see. And of course, being exposed that way, you had no rocker box full of grease. And practically every time you landed, you would have to get your grease gun out and grease them again. But you never ran out of grease, because all you had to do is climb up and scrape it off the windshield. I've hauled quite a lot of hydraulic pipe in that. It had a sliding hatch over the cockpit, and the only way you could load the hydraulic pipe was to slide that hatch back and run it back this way. Now, that airplane I sold to Lindemuth, and I don't know who it was. I think it was he. Came out to the Merrill Field, and he pulled a propeller through. Maybe I'm blaming him, but somebody did. And he had a girlfriend with him, and he asked her to handle the throttle. I suppose that the instructions to her lacked something, because the engine started, and away it went, hit a telephone pole with one wing, and then it swung around, and this pole went through the fuselage ahead of the stabilizer and separated the tail section from the rest of it. Well, it sat behind the hangar there for quite a while. I didn't come to Anchorage often in those days. I was based in Fairbanks. And I came down for some reason. I saw this there, and it looked so lonesome and so forlorn. I bought it. I think I paid $900 for it. I don't know what for. And I shipped it aboard a flat car back up to Fairbanks. I was working for Harold Gillam at the time on the Kuskokwim mail run. And he allowed me to put it in the hangar, and I wanted to build it up. And I found out that this corrugated skin was not the same as the Ford Trimotor. Smaller wrinkles. So I rode all over to find out where I could buy some of this corrugated skin, and there wasn't any. But there was a company that sold sheet Doral, who said they would make up the dyes and roll some out for me, which they did. I went quite some lengths to get that fixed up. Now, I'd had quite a bit of experience before I came north in Detroit. I worked in a couple of small airplane factories. I was considered myself an expert on fabric work and spray painting, but no sheet metal work. But nothing like that ever deterred me in those days. I was young and confident, so I did 90% of this work all myself. I put it all together and got the tail coupled on there, and it was ready to go. And Toivo Aho came in one day, and he says, "Say, I'd like to buy your Hamilton. What do you want for it?" I don't know what I wanted for it, but I really had no use for it, because I was flying for Gillam. And he wanted to pay cash. So I said, well, it's ready to go, but I haven't test flown it yet. And he said, well, I want to get back to Anchorage. He said, just shove it out of the hangar, and I'll test fly it on the way to Anchorage. So he paid over the money, and he test flew it on the way to Anchorage. I understand that things like that aren't done nowadays. In fact, there are several things that aren't done nowadays. So, let me tell you how I soloed, for instance. I had been in the Army Air Service down in Texas. To you young fellows, you must understand that there's an Air Force now, and before that there was an Air Corps, and before that there was an Army Air Service. And I joined the Army Air Service soon after it was became an independent branch from the Signal Corps. We had DH-4Bs, and they had a few Jennies and whatnot. And when I got out, I went up to Detroit, and they were forming a National Guard unit, an observation squadron. So I joined up. I was kind of lonesome, you see, for the military life. And eventually I worked for them full-time as a in the office and other types of work. Well, I had never flown, but some of the pilots had taken myself and a couple of others up and given us instruction in the air. I had 66 hours of dual instruction. I could do any kind of aerobatics that had been invented up to that time, but I'd never landed an airplane because it was against the rules. And if the pilot took me up and I pulled a boo-boo, why, he'd have to take the blame. So I was sitting on the front steps. We didn't have an airport. The city let us use a park there. Rouge Park had a grassy field, and we put a little tin hanger, Truscon hanger on there. And sitting out front with a friend of mine, Dan Bergan, and a fellow landed a brand new OX Traveler. This fellow, Bill Matheson, was the son of a fairly wealthy man there, and he had used his allowance to buy this new Traveler, but he didn't tell his folks because they didn't want him to fly. And he came over and sat down and talked, and Dan knew him quite well. And he says to Dan, would you like to fly the airplane? And Dan says, well, he says, actually, I'm not ready for solo yet. And he says, Barr, why don't you fly it? And I said, well, sure, I'd like to, but, and Matheson says, well, sure, go ahead. So I went to get my helmet and goggles, came out, and Matheson said, I'll go around with you once. And that was normal, of course. So two young people, again, the OX Traveler had the pilot in the rear in a single cockpit, and there's space for two up front so you could carry passengers. And the control stick you take out, you see, when you're carrying passengers, or if you put it in when you're giving instructions. Matheson, in the back, and I took off, and I made a couple of real nice landings, and he climbed out and said, go ahead, practice as much as you want to. And I flew around quite a bit, and I came in, and I thought, well, there's a nice fellow. The least I can do for him is to give him some good government gas for this. So I taxied up to the gas pump, climbed out on the lower end, in the front of the gas tank, and as I looked, in the front cockpit, there were no controls in it. You know? Bill had just gone around for the ride on the first stage. That hasn't been now either, is it? Well, of course, I flew a Pilgrim the most. That was my favorite. I bought one from American Airlines in Texas and flew it up here. Had two of them. One, and PA had, I think it was one at that time, and now there's only one. They had either a Cyclone or a 500 and 700. It was built by Fairchild. They had the regular Fairchild V stick. And it was designed for American Airlines so they could have a little more cheaper, have wind tail, you see. up front. He put it up front in the little sliding window so he could see the passengers back here. But they had lots of baggage compartments, nice reclining seats, and a biffy in the rear. And I think I had the only airplane with indoor plumbing, except maybe the Ford Trimotor. But I carried mostly freight. Now, Bob Rooney said many times that he preferred to carry passengers first to the airport and then to the sort of a bulky. They put baggage compartments down along the road and see them. Afterward, it looks somewhat like a pregnant whale. And really slow, you could hear it coming. And it would land anywhere, just like it said. The thing I looked for by now is if you see tears in the airplane, it would not pass. It would. I have taken it up to the full load where it took 4,000 feet for it to go. And it took it up to the 800 foot river bar. And it used all 800 feet. And it would land them. Or something, and it would slide the full length and then stop with its nose in the bushes. Peculiar way of flying, and I developed the habit of flying into these short airports because you always have a little extra speed. Speed, you see, and this time I feel controlled good. Sometimes if I feel coming in a little difficult, I move a little up and down like this. I didn't realize how this was going to be before. So I told him to stand in the airport, and one of the mechanics came out and said, "Bob, I'm going to be able to do it." He says, "Well, you know how to do that. I'm going to be able to do it. One time, I came sliding down there on the street and I saw the train going on the ground. And I thought, I thought it was a lift. It was a bad hit. And I was going to lift the ladder. And I continued to get in there and I was going to lift the ladder. But after he came to where it was coming in, he thought he was going to lift the ladder. And he's been living ever since. So I trained him properly. said to me one day, John Cross, so I'm glad to learn now that the century plus
flying boat with us. It's even a flying engine. I would love to find
two carburetors, and I knew I'd find
a flying engine. Thank you.
took herself seriously and took her job very seriously. She was not exactly the Alaskan. And the passengers loaded to go to Anchorage. It was late in the afternoon. And one fellow passenger had been sitting at the bar, and he had about two drinks. He didn't have too much, but he sat down next to the window, and he sort of nodded and settled back, and the airplane took off. And pretty soon he looked out the window, and I guess he wasn't used to airplanes. The exhaust pipe was sort of red, and there was about that much flame coming out the end. And he said, "Stewardess, look, do you see that?" He said, "Yes, you see that? Is that you can't tell me that's normal. Yes, sir, that is perfectly normal. Well, for my peace of mind, will you please go call the captain of the attention bill? Because they were authorized to go and find the captain. She marched up to the front office, you know. After the officer came back, marched in my face to the front of the building. Whatever you need to hear, he said, "Sir, the captain said,